First of all, I'd like to say that I'm very pleased to be invited to give this talk. I've just come from Melbourne. I've been in Australia for 2 months. And the reason I'm here in the Southern Hemisphere is because I was invited by a very good friend to spend time with him in Australia, which I've just done. I enjoyed very much. And then Ratnaview has said that the Saranar Trust have very kindly offered to pay my fare from Australia to New Zealand and back. So, and they invited me to do a little bit of what I would call Dharma input. So I just hope you get your money's worth. Anyway, I was in Melbourne a few weeks ago on a Saturday lunchtime, and I was sitting on at a terrace outside a cafe. It was very, very pleasant, sipping coffee, and coffee in Australia is fantastic. And I was looking across the road at a famous bookshop called Readings. And under the title Readings, it said, established in 1969. And I thought, well, that's quite recent. And then a little bit later I thought, well, it's not necessarily recent. It's nearly 50 years. And our movement was founded in 1967. And in 2017, that'll be 50 years. So in 2017, there'll be big celebrations here and in Australia and all over the world to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Tri Ratna Buddhist community. So I know that half a century is not an eon, it's not an age, but it's a modest stretch of history, 50 years. And you could argue that Tri Ratna Buddhist community is still a sapling, a very sturdy sapling. You could say it's even a small tree. So it's well established, but it's beyond the state, at least I think, it's beyond the state of being knocked over. It's a very sturdy, healthy tree. I've only have to look at this lovely centre in Auckland, very beautiful centre, very beautiful shrine room. And that was a similar experience in Melbourne, lovely centre, lovely shrine room. And last year I was in Amsterdam doing a little bit of teaching, and the centre there is lovely, the people are great, and it's a very thriving centre. And it was the same in Berlin when I went there, also last year. And I'm going to Wellington next week. I expect it's the same there. And I read this morning, just by accident almost, that recently there were a few ordinations in Australia. And one of those men who was ordained marked the 2,000th order member. So we now have 2,000 members of the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order. So what a lot we've achieved, has been achieved, since those very early days. But yes, I was around in those days. I was a young man of 30 in 1967. So I thought when I came to Australia and New Zealand, people might well be interested in what I have to say about those early days. Because I think, as I hope will become clear as I speak, they were very, very important, significant days. I mean, it's a very happy coincidence that I first came across the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha, in the same, almost the same month as the Tri Ratna Buddhist community. It was then called the Friends of the Western Sangha, was actually conceived and born. So I only realized that the other day when I was thinking about what to say. And I look on that as a happy coincidence. So yes, my involvement with the FWBO, as it was known then, Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, and now the Tri Ratna Buddhist Community, it constitutes a long period of my life history. I've been a practicing Buddhist now for the greater part of my life. And the early days of the movement are now, for me, far enough back in time to take on, for me at least, a sort of mythical hue. It's not exactly easy for me to explain what I mean by mythical hue. The right flavour is something that a famous Zen teacher called Dogen said. And he said, there's Amitabha, the Buddha of infinite light, and there's old man Gautama. So there's the historical Buddha who died when he was 80, and also who belonged to what we call in Dharmic terms the Karmaloka, or the world of sensuous experience, which we are in at the moment. But there is also the Rupaloka, which is a mythical realm where one can experience these very beautiful different coloured Buddhas, like Amitabha, the Buddha of infinite light. So on the same lines, there's the graft and sheer hard work of getting a centre like this together. It didn't all just happen. There's been a lot of sweat and tears probably going into the creation of a centre like this, which goes back actually to 1974 when the movement was first started in New Zealand. There's a lot of hard work gone into that, a lot of human endeavour. So there's that, which is actually very good to be involved in. I've been involved in that myself, but it's really hard work, and it leads also, I have to admit, to difficulties of communication. But you stick at it and they can be overcome. But as well as that, there's the magical transformation that happens in people's lives as a result of all that graft and effort. And one of the great pleasures and sort of miracles of being involved in this Buddhist movement for well nigh 50 years is just seeing people change. Yeah, seeing how people change in all sorts of ways, some very quickly, almost like a butterfly coming out of the chrysalis, you know, suddenly they've got wings. And others slogging steadily, you know, day after day, year after year. And then suddenly you see, wow, yes, they've changed. Through practice, through doing the meditations, through all sorts of things that we do in this movement. But I'll come on to that a bit more later. Also, on this theme of myth and history, there was Sangharakshita, the founder of the movement, in 1967, in his flowing ochre robes with his sunburnt skin, just fresh from India. And then later, in the 1970s, there was the old elderly man shuffling around in his carpet slippers. But the magic was still there, but you couldn't see it. Another way of putting it is there's the distinction between the ordinary human being and what Bhante has called the bearer of the archetype. And perhaps it was to do with the fact that in 1967 he'd only recently returned from India. When I first met him, it was even difficult to say whether he was English or Indian. But I'm going to come back to say a few things about Sangharakshita later on. So it was the mid-60s, and I was in Thailand, and I was teaching English in Bangkok. And that journey to Thailand for me, 3 weeks on a cargo boat, was a turning point in my life. I didn't realise to what extent it was a turning point, except until in retrospect. But it was a very significant event in my life. So it captured for me what I call, in mythical terms, the myth of the journey. I've always been fascinated by the myth of the journey. During maths lessons at school, secondary school, I used to read the Odyssey, the story of Odysseus's wanderings, you know, from place to place, instead of doing my maths. I was hopeless at maths. Anyway, that period, and in Bangkok, and a few months and even years later, I came across, or even experienced, what we call the very first stages of the spiral path. We call in the TBC the spiral path, which is the path of spiritual development, which has certain stages. And thinking about what to say tonight, I realise that it fits in with the first stages, early stages of that spiral path. The first stage is, in dependence on suffering arises faith, or in dependence on unsatisfactoriness arises faith. I can't say I was deeply unhappy at the time. I wasn't. And I wasn't consciously searching for anything higher. I'd rejected Christianity a few years earlier, and I was quite happy to have rejected it. And life was okay. I felt quite liberated from the rather restricted life I was living in England. But, and maybe I'm reading back into it now, but there was something unsatisfactory. There was something missing, and I wasn't quite sure what it was. Anyway, one evening, out of the blue, I had my very first taste of the Dharma, my very first taste of the teaching of the Buddha. I was lying on the floor. I have to confess I'd taken a certain substance. But that doesn't negate the experience. And he was reading. This friend of mine was reading from a text, a famous Buddhist text called the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation. And some of you may know that text these days in a new translation called Self-Liberation Through Seeing with Naked Awareness. This text is very important to me. And a few years ago I went to several different centres leading study groups on this text, because it was a text which was so close to my heart. It was my first, very first taste of the Buddha's teaching. So anyway, as I lay there listening to these words, I had a sort of double take response to it. Outwardly, I was sceptical. And I lightly argued with my friend about what the text was saying. It was a bit sceptical, even perhaps slightly cynical. So that was my initial conscious response to these words. But inwardly, I was very deeply affected. And a few days later, to my surprise, I found myself in a bookshop buying the book. And it was a beautiful hardback copy with coloured illustrations inside, and pages that were deckle-edged and thick, and the print was beautiful. And each illustration had a sheet of tissue that you had to peel away in order to see the painting. And the first painting was Padmasambhava, who is a very important archetypal guru in the Theravada Buddhist community. And a lot of order members I know have a very special relationship with Padmasambhava. And when I left Bangkok, I was in India on the way back. I very quickly bought a rupa, a Buddhist statue, because I had to catch a plane and I hadn't found the statue I wanted. And the Tibetan boy in the shop, in the foyer of the hotel, said, "This is the Buddha, this is the Buddha." It's just nothing like the Buddha. I said, no. Anyway, I was so desperate to have something, I bought it. And when I first met Sangharachita, he said, "Oh, good." He said, "That's Padmasambhava." I thought, "Who's Padmasambhava?" Anyway, that was another very lucky coincidence. So I returned to the UK in 1967, May 1967, and I was desperately searching for a Buddhist group so I could talk to people of like mind. And we were sitting at the breakfast table one day and my wife said, "Hey, look at this advertisement." And on the back of the New Statesman, which is a well-known English magazine, there was a little box advert for a retreat for the Friends of the Western Sangha. And it had only been in existence, the Friends of the Western Sangha, for 4 months. There were no order members. Order members came a year later. This was 1967. So it was like, when I first encountered it, it was like just very tiny little green shoots poking up from the soil. And Sangharakshita was standing there in the vestibule of the retreat house, shaking hands with each retreatant as they arrived. And I remember clearly shaking hands with him, this man who was either Indian or English, I didn't know. So this was my second dramatic encounter with the Dharma. First I heard the Tibetan text, and then I met Bhante. So, independence on unsatisfactoriness arises faith in something, faith in what you were looking for, what I was looking for, what was missing in my life. I have found what was missing, or rather, I have found what was hidden. So I suppose I hope you've gathered that this was a very important time for me, and it was a very important time historically for the Tibetan Buddhist community. So I just want to say a few words about the historical background to all this. It was the 60s. It was the famous 1960s, when a kind of general expansion of liberation of consciousness happened, especially amongst young people. This was the cultural seeding ground for the birth of a new Buddhist movement. Many here may have heard the story of Sangharakshita on a train reading a letter from the English Sangha Trust, which told him he wouldn't be invited to teach a second term there. And he immediately looked across to his friend he was travelling with and said, "You know what this means? It means a new Buddhist movement." So I look on that as the conception of the TBC. So for him it was a very liberating moment. He was free at last from the restrictions of the dry conservatism of many aspects of the Buddhist movement at the time. It was also a liberating time more generally. As I've said, I'd come from England and I'd come from a rather restricting, bored life as a teacher in an English school, and suddenly I was in exotic Thailand, even though it was so humid, which I didn't like. And young people, in those days, young people were especially feeling free from the conservatism of the 1950s. And this freedom was voiced, of course, in music. in the music, for example, of the Beatles and Bob Dylan. I hope I'm not sounding too old-fashioned to you. Many of us were experimenting freely with mind-expanding drugs, like particularly marijuana and LSD. And many were seeking for higher states of consciousness through meditation. The Beatles guru, Maharishi Mahesh Yoga, founded what came to be known as transcendental meditation. And I know a lot of people in the movement here in all over the world. They've come to the TBC having first experienced meditation through transcendental meditation. We grew our hair. I had a lot more hair in those days. We grew our hair. And we wore the dress of hippies. And and the men amongst us said, the males amongst us talked in terms of man. Yes, man. No, man. You're speaking rubbish, man. I don't know what the ladies called each other, but we were men. Man. Yeah. And Bob Dylan was very much in the air, literally. So take me disappearing through the smoke rings of my mind, through the foggy ruins of time. Yeah? I ain't sleepy and there ain't no place I'm going to. Mr. Tambourine Man, man. So one sensed this freedom, the open air, the open road, and people were dropping out right, left and centre. They were leaving their jobs and, well, they depended, a lot of them depended on the dole, you know, on social security. But lots of people did it. And I remember one retreat, early retreat, that Bhante led in 1968, 1969, and at the end of the retreat there was a big queue of people outside his room wanting to talk to him, and he told me afterwards that nearly all of them had tried to persuade him that it was time for them to leave their job and take to the open road. So Sangharakshita cashed in on this prevailing zeitgeist that I've been talking about. So it was a highly significant beginning in spiritual terms. And it was one that he felt, he said, he's written about in a book which you may have read, that it was a motivating force which he felt didn't come from him personally. It was a force outside himself. He said he didn't feel like the type of person who would set up a new movement. He'd rather stay in India and meditate. But this force, so to speak, I don't like to use the word force, it sounds a bit like Star Wars, but it was a sort of influence, a higher influence, that he could not but obey. In one of the sutras of Mahayana Buddhism, there's a book about ethics, and in this book there's a chapter called The Ethics of Gathering. The Ethics of Gathering. And getting a teacher, getting together a group of followers, gathering them, is a very, very meritorious thing to do. So this act of gathering is continuing through the years, has continued throughout the history of the movement, of different order members and mitras and friends working together to get people together, to stay together, to gather in order to practice the Dharma and eventually attain enlightenment. So yes, we say in one of our devotional ceremonies, an ever-widening circle, the Sangha grows. And that circle is getting so big. As I said, last week we got the 2,000th order member. So to come across the Dharma by way of a text, as I did, that was quite something, as I hope I've made clear. But then to meet someone who, as it were, embodied the Dharma so palpably in himself was quite another thing. I'll say a little bit more about that later, but I want to just say a couple of things about that first ever Friends of the Western Sangha retreat that I attended in 1967. The first event was a meditation practice, and Bhante went onto the little stage, and we were all sitting in front on upright chairs. There were a few weird people sitting cross-legged at the front, and we thought, how strange, you know. And Bhante introduced us in his very slow, careful, measured voice. He introduced us to the four stages of the mindfulness of breathing. And it was fantastic. The Zen people have something called beginner's mind. So I immediately got concentrated in those few days of the retreat. I think it's because your mind is open and you've no expectations. So you do what the teacher says in each stage. And it was so enjoyable. It was so inspiring. It was a wonderful lift-off. I felt I'd been launched into, you know, a different realm almost. Yes, I'd better watch the time, hadn't I? So, coming back to the spiral path which I mentioned at the beginning, I'd already experienced the first stage. Independence on unsatisfactoriness arises faith. I'd seen that, I'd felt it, I'd really enjoyed it. And then now, with the mindfulness of breathing, independence upon faith arises joy. Yeah? So, it was a very palpable experience. Put your faith in the practice. Believe what the teacher's saying. Do it. And you just experience satisfaction and joy. I'm not saying it's always like that. I don't want to paint too rosy a picture. It's not always beginner's mind. Sometimes it's a bit of a slog, as we all know. But even when it's a bit of a slog, it's having its effect. It's producing fruits. So the mindfulness of breathing has always been a favourite meditation practice of mine. Bhante, not on that retreat, but a few retreats later, he introduced us to the other basic practice that we do in the movement, the metta bhavana, the development of loving kindness. And that wasn't so easy. And I don't think I'm alone in finding the metta bhavana not as easy, well, not as immediately easy as the mindfulness of breathing. But even with the metta bhavana, it'd be a bit of a grind. I'd find it difficult and wonder why I was doing it. But then often, half an hour later, an hour later, even 2 hours later, you experience the fruits quite. I used to find I had this surge of positive emotion. I think, well, where does that come from? I think, yes, we did the metta bhavana a few hours ago. So, just saying those few words about the metta bhavana leads me into the final point I want to make. And that is about another spiritual practice which is extremely important in our community. And that is spiritual friendship, Kalyana Mitrata. In those very early days, I was very fortunate to experience a lot of personal contact with Bhante. I used to long for the retreats. I wasn't living in London. The movement was only a handful of people, really. And I lived in a coastal resort called Bournemouth, and it was a long way from London. So I was sort of, I felt a bit starved until we had one of these retreats, you know. Just to gather for these retreats, fantastic. But I got to know Bhante a bit, and he lived in a flat with a friend in London, and I used to go and visit him, sometimes for a day, sometimes for a weekend. And occasionally he would visit us in Bournemouth, and in that way I got quite a bit of quality time, spent a bit of quality time with Bhante. And a lot of people at that time, you know, had the opportunity of one-to-one contact with the teacher, and that was a luxury which we didn't have, even say 10 years later, as the movement expanded, that was no longer possible, and you had to make an appointment in order to see Sangharakshita for say for half an hour. I found that difficult. Anyway, I said earlier that there was more than a touch of magic about Bhante in those days. I mean, he'd been in India for 20 years, almost 20 years, and in that time he'd steeped himself in the Dharma, doing hours and hours of meditation practice, and gaining teachings from very high lamas who were refugees from Tibet and other teachers from other traditions. So what he had realized as a result of his time in India flowed through him, so to speak, to us. And this is another image which really appeals to me strongly. That there's a stream of influence from the Buddha himself 2,500 years ago through great teachers of the past and great teachers of the present. And these blessings and grace and wonderful influence is coming through to us even now. So I felt this deep attraction to the spiritual teacher. And I think the word magnetic is not too strong. I felt a very strong magnetic attraction. Lots of people did. And it certainly wasn't physical. I would not consider Bhante very attractive physically, but the dharmic influence shone through him, so to speak, and it's as if one wanted to, as it were, feed off it. Anyway, one day when the two of us, Bhante, Sangharakshita and I, had got into a little bit more deeper communication through discussion and talking than usual, he said to me, "I hope you don't feel overwhelmed." And I said, no, Bhante. Of course I did. Because it was like being in the presence of a spiritual giant, you know, this sort of puny weakling and this. So I could quite understand why, in retrospect, why he would say that. "I hope you don't feel overwhelmed." But yes, I did. And then a few minutes afterwards, he said, "I can feel your being quite strongly. I can feel your being quite strongly." And I was, well, of course, I was chuffed at that. But I think that was very important to me, because it's an example of a spiritual friend giving another faith. Often we don't have faith in ourselves. We don't think we're good enough. You know the story, you know. We suffer from a lack of self-worth. So for someone spiritually doesn't have to be as superior as Bhante was to me at that time, but someone who is a bit more advanced, or that day is particularly more lucid than he or she usually is, and says something to you which gives you the confidence which you need, well, I think that's important. So why did I say that? Well, yes, it was a recognition from his side of my spiritual potential. That's the point I'm trying to make. We all have spiritual potential. We all have potential to grow so much bigger, spiritually speaking, than we are now. And maybe we've got that faith. But sometimes we need our spiritual friends to convince us that that is so. Anyway, he also told me in those days that he wanted to be treated as an ordinary human being. He said this a lot. He didn't want to be put on a pedestal. Which I appreciated, and I recognised, and I honoured, as far as I could, to treat him as an ordinary human being. Because I have to confess that I was very guilty in those days of some really naive projections. I'll just give you one little example. A friend of ours invited us, me and Bhante, invited us to a dinner party. And in those days I had a car, and I was driving Bhante across London. And I didn't know where this mutual friend lived, and I thought Bhante did, and I was sure anyway that by his spiritual powers he would go there. So we're crossing London, and he says, "Oh yes, I think it's left here." So turn left, it'd be a dead end, you know. Oh, maybe not. So, yeah. And this goes on for about half an hour. And my belief in his supernatural powers was absolutely smashed in half an hour. So we used to study in the early days a text called Meeting Spiritual Friends. We don't do it so much these days, and I don't know why, but it says in that text, in the beginning of one's career, when we are still living imprisoned by our deeds and emotions, we will have to seek an ordinary human being who can light up the path for us to follow. Because we're at such a low level of development that we won't come across a Buddha, we won't come across a highly developed Bodhisattva, but we will come across an ordinary human being in the form of a spiritual teacher. Well, you may be thinking, from what I've said so far, that I considered Bhante an extraordinary human being. Well, I did. But at the same time, I did see him as an ordinary human being with weaknesses like the rest of us. And to hold these two things together was sometimes very, very difficult. Anyway, the general point I'm making, and I'm going to finish with, is in those days, he insisted on what he called developing horizontal spiritual friendship. Horizontal Kalyana Mitrata, as distinct from vertical Kalyana Mitrata. So the fashion in those days in most Buddhist groups was you had the teacher sitting on high with all the disciples clustered around much lower, looking up. But he used to say, no, well, obviously that is an important element, because you have to look up because you're not so highly developed. But also very important is to look across, to look horizontally, to develop spiritual friendship with one another. He used to stress this so much. And I think that Dante's emphasis on spiritual friendship is an aspect of his spiritual genius, because it's that which has led to a great extent to the development and growth of the movement. And I must say, we didn't find this easy. We all wanted to talk to Dante. Not that we didn't have friends, I don't want to exaggerate, we did have friendships amongst us, but really we wanted to look up, and he was saying, no, you've got to look across. You're as important to each other as I am to you, in a sense. So in that respect, we had a lot of pioneering work to do, because we had to work together. We had to work together to build these centres. We had to work together to form the first residential spiritual communities. And in some case, we were striving to develop friendships with people that in normal social circumstances we perhaps wouldn't look twice at. That's an exaggeration, but there is some truth in it. So it was a very hard practice. And I think it's true to say we have stuck at it. We've really stuck at it. And there is now, in 2016, a vast network of spiritual friendships which came from that seed. And that seed was planted by Dante in those early teachings. So I think now genuine mutual respect, friendship, and even love has developed quite a lot. Now nearly 50 years on. Just to finish, there's an order member called Parami. She lives in England, and she is the order convener for women order members. And one of her jobs is to go to these interfaith meetings, or meetings of different Buddhist groups from all over the world. And she said on several occasions, people have said, either in public or in private to her, that what the Tiratna Buddhist community is good at is spiritual friendship. And I think that's a great compliment. And I'll just finish with this quote, which I came across something Dante said or wrote years ago. And he says, "This is essentially what our whole movement is about. It's a sort of transforming and transfiguring agency. It's not simply a Buddhist movement in the narrow sense. It's a stream of spiritual energy which transforms and transfigures everything and everyone with whom and with which it comes into contact." I was quite struck by that. So driving that transforming energy is the lifeblood of spiritual friendship, circulating through all the arteries and branches of the movement. And really, that's a very important cause or condition, if you like, of why we're all here tonight. So thank you.